Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 121 of Registry Matters. Larry, we've made it yet another week. How are you tonight?
Well, we did make it another week. I don't know how many more we're going to make it with this epidemic, but hopefully a few more.
Well, I will bring something up on that, but before I do that, I want to introduce that we do have a guest joining us tonight. We have Teresa Robertson from Pennsylvania. She is a PhD, and I don't know what an LCPC is, Teresa. Can you tell me what that is real quick?
A licensed clinical professional counselor.
Ooh. And ooh, so you're, yeah. How about that? So you're a licensed psychotherapist in private practice. You've been involved in advocating for rational sexual offense law since 2016, and you are active at both the national and state levels. You're a founding member of PARSAL, which is the Pennsylvania affiliate for NARSAL, and you currently serve as the executive director. And you are a member of the Pennsylvania Reentry Council and co-chair of the PARC subcommittee on those who have sexually offended. And you are engaged in research related to addressing psychological consequences of public registration. And you have presented these results nationally and internationally. You're super passionate and working hard towards solutions to both prevent sexual abuse and honors the inherent worth and dignity of all human beings. Holy cow.
Yeah.
You're doing a lot. I like it.
Yeah, I like it too. I like it too. We're all doing a lot.
And how are you in the great state of Pennsylvania tonight?
In the great state of Pennsylvania, all is well, all is quiet. About, I forget now, they keep adding different counties to the stay-at-home order. My county was added last night at 8 p.m.
Wow.
So.
And what does that mean? Does that mean like no movement except for to the grocery store, or a restaurant still serving food, just only takeout?
Yeah. Restaurants are closed in-house, but you can get curbside service.
Okay.
You can go out to get food. You can go out for medical things. You can go to work if you work at what the governor calls a life-sustaining industry. Wow. So the liquor stores are closed.
Which could be life-sustaining for certain people.
Well, yeah, and that was a big concern at first, but you can still buy beer and wine in the convenience stores and supermarkets because there are people who literally it's life-threatening if they could not get that. So
wow.
They just can't get hard liquor, but the alcohol content in the beer and wine will do. So we'll have to do.
So. And Larry, before the show, I was having a chat with one of our listeners, and he wanted to know how old you really are, and I'm not going to divulge this information, but he wanted to make sure that you were not in one of the risk zones, and, you know, do you have underlying conditions, not just for the podcast, but because he likes you.
I'm anxious that, and I am in the, one of the elevated bands, but they get more elevated as you get older, but I'm over 60, so they're cautioning those people, particularly if they have any respiratory or any challenges, which I don't have. Actually, for a person this age, I'm in relatively spectacular health other than a little arthritis. In fact, I enjoyed last time I was in Georgia with my lifetime friend that his health is not as stellar, and he has to take his blood pressure and his pulse and everything. And I said, put that damn thing on my arm and let's just see what it is. And he couldn't believe how low my pulse rate was and how low my blood pressure was. And I said, well, the doctors
your BP
have
is
told
low because you're actually dead.
The doctors have told me that my heart will not be what takes me out because of what a low heart rate and how strong my heart is. And of course, that means it probably will be what takes me out. But they tell me that I don't have to worry about a heart attack anytime soon.
And not to turn this into the Larry, what your daily routine is, but you do exercise. I've caught you either somewhere near a treadmill or something like that before. You exercise halfway regularly, don't you?
I do a daily brisk walk on a treadmill, and I do a little bit of flexibility stuff, which I should do more than the little bit that I do, because as we get older, our bodies are stiff, and I try to overcome some of that, but it's not nearly enough.
Probably all of us could say that it's not enough, except for the Ironman triathlete kind of whatever, marathon runners. We have a jam-packed show full of all kinds of stuff, Larry, and we're trying to keep the coronavirus stuff to a minimum, but like, there's no more oxygen in the room pretty much of anything else going on in the news, even though there's still stuff going on around the world. It's hard to not focus on anything corona because it's all corona all the time. Don't you think?
it is. It's really devouring. That we just don't have anything that compares to this in my lifetime, and I think many lifetimes before mine, we don't have anything. And one of the things that we have different now is we just didn't say this had been. We'd had the capacity to transmit information the way we do today in 1918, and the what was called the Spanish flu, but actually probably should have been called the American flu since it started in Kansas. But we just didn't have the information. Remember, radio hadn't even, the first stations hadn't signed on the air till 1922. And we had primarily your distribution would have been newspapers, and the newspapers in the major cities. Well, when you went outside a major city, you had weekly newspapers and you just didn't have the information. If we'd have known what we knew medically and we'd had the ability to transmit information around, we probably would have acted in a similar way in 1918, if not worse, but we just didn't know any better. And that's where you had the contrasting cities between Philadelphia and St. Louis, where St. Louis apparently practiced social distancing and Philadelphia blew it off, and they had many times the fatality and infection rate in Philadelphia.
What's interesting about the social distancing thing is I went to Sam's Club this morning and I have a buggy, and the buggy would, you know, buggies at Sam's are very big and it kind of keeps you the right distance away from the people that would be in front of you. But the people behind me were like almost touching my tush. And I'm like, have we not heard about this yet? And I almost like, maybe I should just turn the cart around and, you know, just make a whole circumference for to mark my territory, like get away.
And for those of you who are not in the South, buggy is a colloquial term for a shopping cart.
Oh, see, I don't, I'm not from the South, so I learned buggy somewhere else.
Well, it's very common in the South, but I never hear that term anywhere outside the South. That people refer to it as a shopping cart.
But Teresa, what do you call it? Because you're from up yonder.
I'm sorry, Andy, but that was a first for me. I figured it out because you were at Sam's Club, so I kind of figured out what you were talking about, but I've never heard anyone use that. maybe it's a Western Pennsylvania thing. I don't know.
When I was in the South, that's what we talked about. Someone was sent out to get into buggies. I mean, that was what it is still commonly used. If you weren't familiar with that colloquial term, you'd think of a dune buggy maybe, but it's just not as common outside the South. But we don't want to spend a bunch of time on it. Just remember that our global audience, they would not know what a buggy is.
Interesting. Well, Larry, here's my question for you, and Teresa, feel free to chime in on this. Have you read the 800-page, $2 trillion-plus bill that just got signed?
Absolutely not.
Larry?
I thought you were directing that to Teresa.
No, I was directing it to both of you. I was like, no, just chime in, whichever. Have either of you read it all?
I wasn't even aware that it had been released yet. I know that it's rumored to be between 8, 9, or maybe 1,000 pages, but I have not read it. No, I haven't.
And is it common, do you think, for, you know, I mean, we talk about decisions here on a pretty regular basis, or, you know, laws, and they're a dozen pages, maybe something like that. Here's 800 pages, and I recall in a massive legislation thing that happened maybe a decade, a little bit more ago, and we don't know what's in this thing. And so do you think it's pretty common that the legislators would not have read something of this magnitude up front?
It is very common. And in fact, the process that they used on this stimulus bill was it did not afford itself too much time to read it because, remember, it started in the Senate, and then when it finally passed the Senate after lots of negotiations, the House was told you really need to pass it the way it is. And all the negotiations meant changes were being made continuously up until the Senate actually passed it. And then the House basically passed it the next day. And so therefore, it would be almost virtually impossible for anyone who wanted to read 900 or 1,000 pages. But it's not uncommon at all. That was an unfair criticism that was leveled about the Affordable Care Act, that no one had read it. No one reads any of this stuff in its entirety. You glance at the summary, you glance at key parts of it that interest you, but federal legislation is extremely complex.
Yeah, same with the
lengthy. Nobody reads it.
Right. That was the same with the tax legislation, the tax cuts last year. thousands of pages.
Was that? Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
And then the comment will always come out of like, well, we'll know what it does when it happens, or, you know, something like that.
Well, that was a comment that was taken out of context with what Leader Pelosi said at the time. I think she was Speaker Pelosi at the time, but she said that Americans, once they found out what was in it, what she was acknowledging is that most Americans, such a comprehensive piece of legislation, would have no idea what was in it. But once they found out about the good points that were in it, like the precondition prohibition against not insuring, and the being able to keep the student, the household member to age 26, and there were many provisions in there that Americans and even the Trump administration have decided that they support all of a sudden. But that was the context that was taken out of it. And when you're politically opposing someone, it's really fun to take something out of context and play it over and over again. And that's what they did with the opponents of that, a federal takeover of healthcare. And they did focus groups on that. And that sounded really, really good, because I don't want no federal takeover of my healthcare. And then they came up with that and the death panels, and that was all a politically motivated thing about that people don't read it. And intellectually honest, seldom does a piece of legislation get read by any member of Congress in its entirety. They just can't.
Anything else to add, Teresa?
Nope. Sorry. This is Larry's territory.
Oh, I totally know that, but maybe you have something to chime in on, and I just want to make sure that you feel free to chime in anytime. I don't want you to feel left out. We'll get to definitely stuff that's in your neck of the woods here in just a minute.
Yeah, good.
Well, let's do a little bit more on the stimulus bill, because that wasn't all I wanted to say. I think I support the stimulus bill. I don't really know, because I don't know what all is in it. I do know that we have an unprecedented crisis, and the government has exacerbated it with the lockdowns. I'm not criticizing any of the governmental decisions, but it's one thing when the economy shuts down because of lack of demand, of course, the credit crisis, and because of the bubbles that many different bubbles that burst back in 2008, 2009. It's another thing when the economy is relatively firing on most cylinders, performing quite well, when a pandemic comes along and you're ordered to shut down. So I'm not going to criticize the stimulus per se. But what I would like to use this as a moment to educate people about how the process works, because one thing that has driven me crazy through the years is that the PFRs, and for those listening for the first time, that's persons forced to register. There's this constant criticism about how that various things like the Adam Walsh Act in 2006 was passed without any debate in the middle of the night, and all these sinister things. And then they said the same thing when the International Begins Law passed in 2016. None of that was true. Just as if it is everything that happened with this. Everything went exactly according to how the system was designed to work. For whatever reasons, Speaker Pelosi and the House decided that they weren't going to be in D.C., and I don't know what their reasons were. But since they weren't in D.C. and this crisis was unfolding, the leadership, at the behest of the president, wanted to put together an economic package. And they started with talking about taking off Social Security taxes off payrolls for employers and off the individuals. And then they moved towards this broader package, and it was put together by the Republican leadership. And they put it forward, and they couldn't get it to the finish line of the Senate because of the rules of what we call cloture, meaning you have to have 60 votes, which is a supermajority. The Republicans only have 53 votes. So therefore, they could not move their originally designed Republican proposal to the finish line of the Senate without negotiating. So therefore, when the Democrats refused to join in cloture on something that they had not had any input on, then there was a lot of intense negotiations. The Republicans wanted to have less accountability for businesses than the Democrats did about the hundreds of billions of dollars. And the Democrats wanted more to flow directly to workers, like the extra $600 a week of unemployment on top of your state benefit that you're going to be receiving. And so we ended up with a negotiated package that passed the Senate 96 to nothing. Then since the House wasn't in session, the question becomes how to pass it, because it has to pass the House. And there's a process called unanimous consent. And that means that of the 435 members of the House, if a single member disagrees with it, then they can't pass it by unanimous consent. And that's a normal, standard, appropriate parliamentary procedure. You can do that when you're having a meeting. You can say, oh, I move that we pass this by unanimous consent. And if one person on the board of directors or one person in that group raises their hand, then you get to have debate. Well, I anticipated, and so did the talking heads, that there'd be some people have opposition to it. So they weren't able to pass it by unanimous consent. But unanimous consent is a process that exists to move things quickly where there's unanimous agreement. That's why they call it unanimous consent. Why do you need to have a debate if everyone agrees that this is in the best interest of the nation? Well, there was a representative from Northern Kentucky that did not agree, that decided that he wanted to stick his head out and say, I don't agree with spending this much borrowed money without having some discussion. So therefore, they had to achieve a quorum in the House. They had to override his objections, have a minimum amount of debate, and then they took a vote and they passed it. And now it has been signed by the president. There was nothing sinister about how this was done. There was nothing sinister about how the Adam Walsh Act was passed. There was nothing sinister about how International Bacon's Law passed when it went through the process, and then it went back for concurrence to the House after the Senate amended it, and they put the passport marker on as an amendment in the Senate. Nothing sinister at all happened. That is the way the process was designed to work, and it worked exactly the way it was designed.
What about, from his point of view, or from the point of view of all the other people that had to then come back to, you know, a potentially infected area, because there are people in Congress that are being tested positive and whatnot. You know, Mitt Romney was false, but Rand Paul tested positive. You know, now you're putting these people directly in the path of having this done. Couldn't they do it remotely? Couldn't something like that go in place?
Well, the technologically, yes, it could be, but institutional rules change very slowly because we have these long traditions of how they're certain about the decorum of the House and the decorums that are followed and the hear you, hear ye, and all this stuff. And so even though the technology exists, the House, I mean, the television existed for a good, I think, about close to 40 years before we had cameras, before we allowed cameras in the House of Representatives. I think television started in the 40s and it went to the late 70s before C-SPAN. So 50, at least 30 years. So the rules don't permit that, apparently, to do the debate remotely. So they have to achieve a physical quorum. So therefore, enough members had to return. But this representative is named Thomas Massie. He was elected in 2012, and he promised that when he ran that he was going to be fiscally conservative, and he was not going to be signing off on deficit spending. And the citizens of his district elected him, and he's trying to keep true to his word. Now, make it clear, I can just about guarantee you, without knowing anything about the guy, that I wouldn't support much of anything that he stands for, because I think it's silly to think we can downsize the federal government to the size it would take to balance our budget. I've said that on this podcast. Therefore, I doubt that I would be in favor of hardly anything this man stands for. But I do favor that a person who runs for office and who gets elected on a platform, that they be allowed to do what his conscience dictates. I think the president was wrong to tweet out about him being a third-rate congressman, and that he should be stripped of his membership in the Republican Party. And I think the Democrats like John Kerry, who was the candidate for president and Secretary of State, I think Secretary Kerry was also wrong. The citizens of this district that he represents, they will decide. And it's not his fault that Congress decided to go home, that the House of Representatives decided to go home. They didn't have to go home. They could have stayed in D.C. and dealt with this crisis. The Senate stayed there. So we have to find out why they went home and who actually caused the risk. It wasn't Representative Massie. He didn't make the decision to adjourn, to recess the House.
I understand. Now can we move on?
Sure. Thanks.
All right, so here's some break.
It's always an educational opportunity, and I hate to pass it up.
Oh, I know, I get it. That's totally fine. Here is late breaking news. You dropped this in on me just a few moments before the show, and this is a May versus Ryan. And do you want to go over what's going on here?
We're not going to spend a lot of time. We've talked about it on previous podcasts for those long-term listeners, and we just got this yesterday, so it truly is late-breaking news. But it's a case that Narsil did submitted an amicus brief on sometime back, a couple of years back, maybe more than 2 years, but it's been some time back. And the issues at the time were that the sexual battery in Arizona did not require that the person, that the state prove that they intended to commit, that you can touch the person and commit the battery without having a sexual intent. And the person has to prove under Arizona law that they didn't have a sexual intent, that the touching was for a legitimate reason. And so we felt that the burden shifting was unconstitutional. So we opined, because the district judge on his habeas claim had said that the statute was unconstitutional, we weighed in and said, yes, the district judge got it right. Well, unfortunately, the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit didn't see it that way. This is a very tragic outcome, because he was convicted of 5 counts, sentenced to 15 years consecutive on each one. He was one of the rare people that got released from prison while his habeas was pending, because the judge issued an immediate release forthwith when he granted habeas relief back in 2017. The district judge did an unusual thing and said, release this man immediately. He's been out for 3+ years now, no problems. And the Ninth Circuit has said, nope, we extinguished your claim about the burden shifting being unconstitutional because it was foreclosed, procedurally abandoned. And then they said, your ineffective assistance to counsel doesn't fly because your counsel was very effective. He went to trial. He was convicted. And the issue was the jury had deadlocked, and then they wished to reconvene and start deliberating after they had been dismissed. And neither party objected at the time. And the two of the three judges on the appellate panel said, well, that's not ineffective assistance. I mean, brilliant minds can disagree about whether you can let a jury continue to deliberate, and some people think it'd be in the best interest of the defendant to have the jury go on because they might be permanently deadlocked and he might get a mistrial and walk away and the state may not retry him. So ineffective assistance of counsel is a very tough thing to prove. And if any of our legal beagles read this opinion, it'll be very helpful for you to learn that it's just almost impossible. If your attorney is breathing and they do anything that resembles defending you, there's broad latitude allowed for them to make decisions on terms of strategy, and you don't get the benefit of hindsight to look back and say, well, clearly we know now that letting the jury continue deliberating was not such a brilliant idea because they convicted him. But we didn't know that at the time, and the appellate review discourages looking back to see, because you didn't know that information at the time. He thought it was a wise decision at the time, and he didn't object.
That's very complicated, Larry, and very nuanced.
It's very sad also. We've gotten to know this person, and he's been a thriving, productive member of both the state chapter in Arizona, the national chapter, and he's also been productively employed and doing quite well. And as the dissenting judge pointed out, this probably means the rest of his life in prison, because he's not a spring chicken to begin with, and he's got to finish out his 75 years, and he's only served 10. So whatever good time reductions they would be under Arizona law, which I don't know. But if you're already 45, 50 years old and you've got 75 years to do, even if they give you a day-for-day good time, there's a good chance that you might not survive prison and get out again.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, he's a good dude. I know him as well.
The only question is, what do you do from here? And as we've described, as you continue to appeal cases, the funnel, the spout gets narrower and narrower because the options continue to decline. He's only got a couple more options left. He can ask for full court review by the entire Ninth Circuit, which is over 20 judges, more than 20 judges. They seldom grant that because everybody would want it. Or he can file a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, which they grant about 1% of them. And those are all long shots. Or he can ask the governor of Arizona for clemency if they have that power, which we know that for a sexual offense, it would be a long shot even if the governor has that power. So his options are very, very, very limited, and very sad that this has come to this.
Very, very sad. Well, Teresa, if you would be so very kind, you this got brought up just before we started recording as well, and this is you guys had a press release that got published in relation to. Tell us about what's going on here.
Yeah, I just found out about it while just before we started this evening. So that the press release was picked up. So last week, actually, we have been waiting for the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to issue opinions on five different cases, one that was heard in October, four that were heard in November or argued, and the one that was argued in November was Commonwealth of the Butler, and that was the Superior, and that's the one, the press release was related to that. So the Pennsylvania Supreme Court released their decision last week, and we were very unhappy about it because they did not rule in the appellate's favor. Basically, the Superior Court of Pennsylvania, this person had argued that the SVP designation in Pennsylvania was unconstitutional, using arguments from Muniz and the Superior Court agreed with him. So that was a great win. However, it was appealed and went to the Supreme Court, and they've reversed that decision. So the Superior Court applied Muniz. The Supreme Court says that the Superior Court applied Muniz incorrectly because SVPs are a separate class. And the Supreme Court said, in their opinion, incorrectly, that because studies show that SVPs are much more likely to recidivate, that they are a significant danger to society. And so it's not punitive. It's a collateral consequence. So that ruling just came out last week, and we were very excited. We sent a press release out, and just before this podcast, we learned that at least one of the outlets has picked it up. So that's good. I'm getting a voice. And I read it quickly before we started, and it looks like they did a good job in terms of presenting what we put out there. So that's the Butler case. Nonetheless, my understanding, so some of the folks at Parcel have talked with two attorneys in the state who are allies, and they agree that the language that was in this particular opinion is pretty favorable in terms of how the Supreme Court might be leaning in these other four cases that are coming up. That they're thinking that these next opinions that are released, hopefully within the next month or so, three of them challenge the constitutionality of SORNA 2 in Pennsylvania. One of them is challenging civil commitment for minors in Pennsylvania. But the three that are looking at SORNA 2, it appears that the language in the Butler opinion might be a little bit of a hint that those three will come out in our favor.
Larry, do you want to chime in anything there?
I didn't get the opportunity to read it, so I probably wouldn't be able to add anything to what Teresa said, and congratulations to getting your press release. That's one of the cover.
Yeah.
That's one thing that we really strive is to get the media to discussing and contacting us to ask us for our viewpoint rather than just going to the prosecution office and going to the law enforcement apparatus. So congrats on that.
Yeah. Thanks. Getting a voice.
Just a quick roll back. What is an SVP again?
So sexually violent predator. So in the state of Pennsylvania, the SOAB, Sex Offense Assessment Board, has a process by which they determine whether or not anyone who has been convicted of a sexual crime is a sexually violent predator. We have serious problems with that process and don't believe that the way risk is determined in this state is indicative of whether or not someone actually is a sexually violent predator or not. But that's another story altogether. So that's what the term is.
Okay. And is that a standard, Larry, is that a standard that applies equally across all of our 75 states?
Which standard is that, Andy?
Determining who is or isn't an SVP.
Well, every state doesn't have a sexually violent predator. We don't have such a creature here.
So right out of the gate, the answer is no.
The answer is no. Some states have a process by which it's determined through the court, which Pennsylvania does it through the court. They have to have a hearing and some due process, and I'm sure it's flawed, but it doesn't just automatically. The SOAB doesn't have the final say, so according to my understanding, it has to be determined by the court after they've had a hearing. Is that correct, Teresa?
Yes, but basically they rely heavily on B.
Well, they're not experts in the subject matter, but there is a due process adversarial proceeding where they have judicial review.
There is a due process, but actually Butler originally in the Superior Court challenged that due process as being flawed, and it was after the Superior Court's decision, it was determined that this should be determined beyond a reasonable doubt, which it is not.
So, I agree with you on the due process. It's kind of like the risk the system in Arkansas that exists to give someone the level 1 through 4. Mm-hmm. It's not a perfect process. They go through an assessment process at Pine Bluff, and there is a due process. It's always flawed because the offenders never provided the resources that they need. The standards are usually too murky in terms of who bears the burden. And it leaves the court in a lurch if it's a decision by a judge, and if the judge happens to be elected like they are in Arkansas, it's better to err on the side of caution.
The processes are not going to be
perfect, but due process doesn't mean a perfect process.
I agreed. One of the reasons I think a big issue here in Pennsylvania is because there isn't consistency, number one, in terms of the assessment processes. And the other thing is the restrictions on people with that designation are pretty horrendous. People in Pennsylvania who have an SVP designation are required to go to mandated counseling for the rest of their lives.
I assume that they pay for it too, right?
Oh, yeah, they pay for it too. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, as a therapist, I can tell you that there's a saturation, you know, and ethically, we should not be providing services to someone who's not benefiting. And if there's a saturation point, you're required to be there, even though you've already reaped all the benefits you can from this process. Nonetheless, for the rest of your life, you're in treatment.
I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, but can we go there for a minute about like the treatment providers and getting paid and releasing them and the conflict of interest in letting someone go from your revenue stream?
Sure. I mean, I am not I'm not even licensed in Pennsylvania. I'm licensed in another state. And I don't provide mandated treatment. So I'm not in that realm. I am a member of ATSA, but that is focused mainly on therapy that I provide to MAPS, minor attracted persons who have not offended, as well as research that I've done for dealing with people who are on the registry. I'm not in a position, I'm kind of hemming and hawing because I don't have real specifics in terms of what I know about what goes on in terms of this, treatment and a revenue stream is from the, from my work with Parsol and what I hear from people in the state who are on the registry and the fact that magically people successfully complete treatment when their probation ends, or in the case of an SVP, they die. And that's just not individualized treatment. So I can't help but think that you know, one person might be in treatment for 6 months and somebody else for 7 years. You know, if that person was in treatment for 7 years and then was the paperwork is all signed off, the treatment plan is completed, this person completed successfully, and it happened to be the week before they were released from probation or parole. However, if that person had been released from probation or parole after 2 years, they would have completed after 2 years. So, I mean, that makes me go, you know, kind of things that make you go, Right. So, I mean, I don't have any inside knowledge, and I will say this, though, I have heard from folks in the community, too, who have that there are some people out there who are really happy with their providers. And one in particular, who's actually a Parsol board member, who was in a very, I would say, sketchy treatment program and was kicked out. And this particular person is a designated SVP, and he is not on paper, so he's not on parole or probation, but he is, because he is an SVP, required to go to therapy for the rest of his life. Our state law says that you must go to therapy at least once a month, and his provider insisted that he go every week for the rest of his life. Part of the treatment agreement was that no one is allowed to be on any social media. And this particular person had a Facebook account, and the treatment provider found out about it and kicked him out of the program. He lives in a relatively rural part of the state, and that provider was the only provider available. If he had not found another provider, he would have had to go back to jail, even though he was not on parole or probation. But because he was an SVP, he would have had to continue therapy. If he didn't, he would go back to jail. So he ended up finding a provider that was quite a distance away. He still does have to travel to get to that provider, but he's quite happy because that particular provider provides services that are pretty state of the art. You know, he focuses on good lives model and the whole person as opposed to the relapse prevention model that is so popular in this country. And I don't want to – what I'm saying is, like, just like anything else, there's a continuum, you know, in terms of quality of provision. And I'm sure that there are some people providing – services in a way that has nothing to do with when somebody happens to not be in parole and probation anymore and when they've actually, you know, reaped all the benefits they can possibly reap. Nonetheless, it doesn't make it okay that the other end of the spectrum.
I think we can move on to our normal content. I think. And one of the main reasons why I wanted to have Teresa on is because so many of our people are even extra impacted while at the same time better prepared for this whole lockdown from everybody. But I wanted to get the specific insight from Teresa on dealing with the different levels of stress for registrants in general, but now also with COVID-19, and maybe some of these things can apply to quote unquote normal people as this all goes on, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
In the first article, I happen to be listening to a tech podcast where I found this, and the title is How a Futurist Copes with Uncertainty. And I hear this woman speaking quite often, and she's pretty stellar. She does advisement work for large companies, and she put together a very beginner's guide to dealing with trying to figure out like pros and cons of things or pit this idea against another idea. Larry, I think you do this naturally. When you're trying to analyze the strategy behind looking at a bill, like we've talked a bajillion times about the Georgia case with the signs, and what is their next move going to be? Just always trying to plan out your next chess move, so that you can see what's coming down the pike, and nothing ever then surprises you. Well, of course they were going to do this, and I was really intrigued by this article in that it described how. Just different ideas, different scenarios that you could use for pitting the different elements of things against each other.
Are you wanting my comments or Teresa's? Because she's the expert on this stuff.
All of the above. I want because you Larry are certainly adept at planning ahead. You know, we've talked about why weren't the hospital administrators prepared for all of these things, and it seems like you could build a matrix of knowing what's coming down the pike. And of course, Teresa being the expert in the field and dealing with people as clients, that you have specific examples of dealing with the various stresses that are related to the registry.
Right. With uncertainty. Yeah. I mean,
Teresa, why don't you begin?
Well, I would tell you, like, one of the things when I looked at that article that struck me was this, there's a focus on the preparation, and I can't talk about, you know, preparing for the pandemic, but in terms of people preparing for dealing with the uncertainty that's related to this pandemic, I mean, that's a very skillful thing for any of us to do, to kind of look ahead, think about what might happen and what we need to be prepared for. That just makes common sense. And in terms of our own well-being, mental health, as well as health. However, I think that it's equally important for folks to kind of do that and then move on, not move on, but move back into the present moment. A lot of the folks that I'm have worked with this past week who are having difficulty because they're trying to prepare for the unknown. And they want all the answers, and we're not going to have the answers, and we can't do it. And that just increases our stress. So being able to reasonably kind of, yeah, I need a couple weeks of food in the house. I need to make sure that I have the ability to contact my mother on a regular basis to check in and make sure she's okay. Whatever it is, like, we think about that stuff. We have our little plan, and we're not going to cover all the bases, but in order for us to be able to feel as calm as possible under these really trying situations, we really need to be in this present moment, right? So I think we need to find a balance between preparation and living our lives in this moment.
Very interesting. Larry, describe, if you would, how you look at things like from policy point of view, from a politics point of view, and start pitting that against how you strategize out and try and reduce uncertainty in dealing with legislature or even in your own life personally.
Well, by nature, my DNA is to imagine. I always imagine what can happen, and then I assign it a probability factor. If I had been asked to imagine a global pandemic, since I'm not an expert by any means in this, I wouldn't have been able to have imagined something that's locked down the society, the norm, the way we have it has to us. But what I would have been able to imagine, and I'm disappointed that it wasn't imagined, would have been in terms of preparation for the basics. We're not going to be able to justify having millions of respirators and ventilators available because they're just too expensive, and when we have so many competing things for our limited public financing, we're not going to be able to justify that. Nor can we expect a hospital to have that. But what does stress me a little bit is that basic things are not that expensive. They don't have the degradation quality. It would be like, I'm wondering when hospitals simulate reasonably expectations of what could happen. You would think that they would model out, if all the staff walked off the job one day, that they would model that out. They would model out what would happen if the primary source of power went down. What would happen if the water got contaminated in their city? Because you still need to keep treating patients if the water gets contaminated, if a terrorist puts something in the reservoir. So you'd think they would model out that, and you'd think they would model out things like surgical gowns and face masks and basic stuff. Again, how far do you take that? And where do you take your models? And what could happen versus the cost that would be required to prepare for that? Surgical masks, face masks and surgical gowns were not that expensive, and they last quite some time. So you'd think that we wouldn't be having this shortage, because you'd think hospital administrators would have thought about having backup supplies of the most basic stuff. And that's what I think a job of a hospital administrator is. And then we've been told that locals are so much more brilliant than those bureaucrats up in Washington, D.C. And therefore, I'm a little disappointed that I hear so much criticism of the administration And I hear so little self-critique and criticism of the local officials about what they should have done, because my hometown over in Newton County, Georgia, they have a nice general hospital, about 100 beds, and they have a board of county commissioners and a city administration, and they could have provided for provisions, and I'm sure the town would have been more than happy, and the county would have been more than happy to help them store up provisions that would have been needed in the event that our just-in-time inventory system of America, if the supply chains got broken. So I'm a little disappointed in that stuff, but what I try to do is to try to imagine from a political point of view, or from an adversarial point of view, if I'm in litigation, I try to look at what I would do if I were representing the other side, if I were arguing the other side, and I try to imagine everything that they could come up with, because I have never assumed I'm smarter than the rest of the world. I assume that anything I can think of, so can they. And if I can think of it, it's a concern, because if I thought of it, they're probably going to be able to think of it. So that's what I do, is I go through all these scenarios of if I were trying to oppose this legislation, what would I do to kill it if it's something we're for? And the other way around, if I'm trying to pass something on their side, what would their logical moves be to try to neuter us and get past our opposition? And I do a lot of imagining of what could happen, and to consternation of a lot of our listeners, because I end up making comments about, in the case of Pennsylvania, when the decision came down in Munez, I had one of the loyal supporters up there really irate, saying that irate is a little strong, but very distressed, that I would say that they would do everything they could to protect the registration, including appealing it and including passing a new statute. That's exactly what I would do if I were in their position. If I had their job to do, that's exactly what I would do. It doesn't require genius to figure this stuff out. If you've got a mob mentality out there that wants to keep the registry alive, and your existence depends on, you also have a family to feed, and you have a job to do, you would try to figure out a way to keep the registry alive, because that's where the people are. So it didn't take a genius to figure that out. It's like Ted Turner said when they asked him how he knew that there was a demand for news outside the standard network news cycles. He said, because everybody can't make those times. He said it doesn't take a genius to figure that out. So I don't consider anything I figure out to be anywhere near approaching genius level. It's just, to me, basic knowledge of putting yourself in the other side's position and knowing what their concerns are. And when you do that, it's really not that hard.
Teresa, and you have some tools that you wanted to talk about in helping people get prepared for different levels of uncertainty, not just registrants, but normal folks.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about being prepared for different levels of uncertainty. It's just kind of being able to deal with, to lean into the uncertainty that we have. Right now, to take, we're all in this together, but it's a lot tougher for some people than others. You know, we have this indefinite social isolation, panic over scarce resources, panic over information overload. Folks who are on the registry, some of this they've been dealing with all along anyway, and now it's exaggerated for many, especially the social isolation piece. And I read this to you earlier, Andy, if it's okay, do you mind if I read this statement that I got
from one of
the guys?
Yeah,
so one of the folks in Pennsylvania who's on the registry sent me an email, and he had this to say, which I thought was really interesting and very insightful. Brilliant, actually, is the word I used when I first read it. So he says, as a side note, I'm curious how the average Joe citizen likes living the way most of us have to live all the time. Can't work, must stay at home unless you have a valid reason to go out, do not associate with others, and people constantly afraid you will somehow infect them, which I just thought was just dead on. So on some levels, people who are on the registry are more prepared already to deal with this because we've had to deal with it anyway on some level. But at the same time, it also adds an extra layer for some people and their social isolation. So we crave social contact the same way we crave food. Our brains neurologically are designed to crave social connection. as well. And that's something people on the registry, many people have had to deal with, that isolation and not getting what they need is. And but now there's an extra layer on that. Some, it's harder for some folks than for others. So even so moving forward and trying to be as intentional as we possibly can be to get that social connection that we need in these uncertain times. And in terms of preparation, again, I'm going back to, there's only so much we can prepare for as individuals. And we, you know, I don't know about you, but I know at my house, we're all, every day or two, we're kind of backing up and regrouping because there's some new news or some new restriction in some way that that we've got to, as a group, kind of get together and figure out, okay, how are we going to deal with this? So we do that as it arises. We have not, like Larry said, I mean, I never would have imagined that I'd be in this position in this moment and was not prepared what happened. Matter of fact, I got off, I went to Brazil and 5 days into my 10-day trip, I found out my flight home was canceled. I didn't anticipate that, and had to rush to the airport. I had three hours to get a flight back, and I was lucky enough to get it. I got home 5 days after I left and was like in shock. Like, what in the world happened while I was gone? You know, everything was different in 5 days when I got back, and I didn't anticipate and wasn't prepared for any of that. Nonetheless, I had to deal with it. So rather than thinking that we can be prepared for this unknown, coming up with what we can, but also continuing to bring ourselves in the moment. Like, okay, this is it. I'm not prepared for this. I didn't see this coming, but here I am in this moment. What can I do that's going to accommodate what I need or what the people around me need as much as possible? So that's, in preparation, I do what we can, but mostly we need to be prepared to deal with the present moment with what comes up. So
how do you know the questions to ask? And like my neighbor, he unloaded on me just a handful of days ago. He is, just barely above minimum wage. He's just a pizza delivery person, which has got to be just about the worst job you could have, because you are forced to go to random people's houses and hand them stuff, and they're going to touch your equipment. You know, you have a pen or whatever. And he's like unloading on me, and he's telling me that I'm the problem because I'm not sympathetic. And I'm like, dude, I'm asking if you need food or money or toilet paper, if you need anything, and I'm the one that's unsympathetic. And even him, he knows my situation, all this stuff, but he doesn't have the tool set available to him to figure out what is overboard, like going like way beyond. I don't think you're going to catch coronavirus by someone touching your pen for them to sign the check and you take it back. And if you then carefully and you sanitize it, I personally, no medical expert, but I don't think that puts you at risk.
Yeah. Well, actually it does. the coronavirus can live. I would be uptight about handing a pen back and to someone all day. So, but anyway, to your question, what's important is to let people feel whatever it is they're feeling and be in this place where there's no right or wrong way to feel in all of this. So basically validating what someone feels. So if someone is like, I'm really uptight, I have to talk to these people every day. I'm passing my pen back and forth. It's simply not asking a question, but simply connecting with them in by saying something like, "That must be really hard for you. I can tell that you're really feeling anxious about that." So basically validating one another. We're all going through different things. I go through different things at different times during every day. and I think most of us do. We kind of go back and forth, depending on what thoughts and emotions are rising in any given moment. But what's important is that we're able to validate not only our own feelings. It's okay to be afraid in this moment. It's okay to feel I mean, there are people I've talked with who also were offended people because they were making, you know, COVID-19 jokes. Well, you know, it's okay to make jokes. Just be careful who you make them with and make sure they're jokes that are funny and not at anyone's expense. As a 65-year-old, I've heard a few that are at the expense of senior citizens. And while they're many of them are clever, they are a little unsettling as well. So
you're not ready to just sacrifice yourself for the economy? Is that what you're saying?
Not quite.
Larry, you're old as Methuselah. Are you ready to sacrifice yourself for the economy?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I want to at this point. And it's the thing that, from what we're hearing, that those who have complications, the complications are significant in terms of the discomfort of being on the ventilator, and that you know, death is a certainty for all of us. But the fear of most, at least for me, I know the fear is not the death, but the fear is how the death will come about. And Dr. Kevorkian is no longer with us, so we don't get to check out on our own terms right now.
That's true. Anything else that you wanted to dive in there, Teresa, before we move on to some of these other articles?
So, in terms of COVID, I mean, I really want to make sure that people are taking care of themselves, you know. So we know that people on the registry, many can access the internet. Right now, the general population is using social media and all kinds of resources on the internet to stay connected with others. And it would encourage, I mean, you can watch Broadway plays online for free. There's Netflix party going on now, free online classes at universities, all kinds of things that we can do online to stay connected and to do it with other people. But there are other people on the registry who don't have access to the internet. Either because of a restriction because of probation and parole, or because they don't have the resources to be able to afford the internet or a device that will help them do that. So, you know, just encouraging people to do what they can in terms of maintaining their normal routine as normal as possible, getting up at a decent hour, getting dressed, not laying around in your pajamas, minimizing news consumption. So if we take in too much of this stuff, it's just going to take us down. So staying informed, again, finding the balance. Stay informed, but just enough to stay informed, not continually reading the news about the virus. Organizing our living space. So when our external environment is all kind of chaotic and messy, it makes our insides chaotic and messy too. Starting new rituals, learning, you know, I talked with somebody who's decided he's going to learn to speak Japanese. So every day he, you know, part of his daily ritual is he takes an hour and is starting to learn to speak Japanese. Doing art, you know, let your soul speak. There's a lot going on in terms of emotions that language just falls short. But we can, if we use creative mediums like watercolors or messing around with some clay or just creating something, it really, the process kind of opens up some of the emotional stuff that's stuck inside of us. So those kinds of things. I think most people are going to make it through here these days, but these tough days we have coming, but some aren't. And if it's okay with you, I wanted to like just provide some information about crisis, where people could reach out for crisis. If this is too tough for them, there is a disaster helpline that's specifically related to COVID-19 on the SAMHSA site. And I believe I'm going to just pass that information on to you, or I can say it now. It's up to you, Larry, or Andy.
No, go ahead, say it. If it's okay, you know, phone numbers and websites.
Yeah, yep, you can call the disaster helpline for COVID-19. The SAMHSA line is 800-985-5990, or you can text the words, all together, no spaces, talk with us, to the number 66746. Talk with us. to 66746. And then there's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Their number is 800-273-8255. They have an online chat, and you can get there by going to suicidepreventionlifeline.org/chat/. And you can text them by texting TALK, TALK, to 741741. I also, you know, I mentioned about being in the moment a bunch of times. I think it's really important. And there are meditation apps, mindful apps, mindfulness apps that are free. The Insight Timer is one. Calm is another, CALM. They're both excellent. They have thousands of practices on there, anywhere from 5 minutes to 25 minutes if you're interested. There are also two websites, selfcompassion.org, meditations. This is a time we need to be very pro-social, not just with ourselves, but with everyone else. There's, you know, kindness and compassion, the sensitivity to our suffering with a desire to alleviate and prevent it goes a long, long way in terms of our being able to tolerate the difficult. So there's Compassionate Mind Foundation in the United Kingdom. I didn't write that website down, but I'll send it to you, Andy. But you can go to selfcompassion.org, and they have self-compassion meditations, guided meditations.
Excellent. Fantastic. Yeah. That all sounds really great.
It is. Good stuff.
Well, we will move on and cover our normal battery of articles. And the first one is going to come from Law 360. Federal prisons can send more inmates home, but will they? Larry, I think that you've said that other nations are sending their folks home, and I think we have some articles that are talking about it, but the U.S. never quite seems to figure out how to do this?
Not in the numbers that other nations are doing it. And what I would encourage, the Attorney General actually directed, the Attorney General of the United States, that is, William Barr, directed the Bureau of Prisons, which is within the Department of Justice. So the BOP director reports to the Attorney General, has directed them to be more aggressive in who they release. They've had these powers always for a long time, not always, but for a long time. But we have the timidity factor, and this administration doesn't have to be as concerned about the timidity factor because this administration has the R before their name, and they're not going to get vilified as much as you are if you have a D and you make a mistake. And you can look back at Willie Horton and when HW ran against Governor Dukakis in '88, how he got vilified for Willie Horton having a furlough in the state of Massachusetts, and he committed a crime. But I would encourage this administration: you're not going to get vilified if you send tens of thousands of people home. It's inevitable, statistically, someone is going to mess up. Go ahead and be honest and accept that someone will mess up. But then let's adopt the law enforcement, what they say. Don't judge 23,000 that you sent home by the 17 that mess up.
Yeah,
sure. Let's deal with the 17. That's what the cops say. Don't judge the tens of thousands of good officers by the few dozen that screw up. And I agree with them, but let's apply that across the board. Let's go ahead and be aggressive and be on the safe side and put these people in early release or on electronic control or in halfway houses or any such thing left out there, because they're probably also in the same position. But let's get these people out of these confined institutions, which we're going to talk about later. We got some pictures coming up from California. But go ahead and do it. You're not going to get vilified for it. Take some chances.
You're not talking about somebody that gets, you know, convicted of murder yesterday to say, oh, we got this virus, you go home tomorrow. You're talking about people that are, they've been there a while, they've proven some kind of track record. Maybe they're at that front end of where they could be released on parole. Maybe like, hey, extend that out to more people. You just mentioned like electronic monitoring. You, like there are tools in place that could be used to figure out what people could be sent home. They're just not doing it.
Well, I would probably not be as selective as you're talking about. If the right circumstances are present, I would even consider people that were recently. I would consider sending Harvey Weinstein out because he's medically fragile. I know that the victims' advocates are going to probably burn my house down tonight when they hear this, but he has probably a death sentence now, and that wasn't his sentence. His sentence was confinement, and we can confine him without having him in the danger zone that he's in now.
You know, there's an article. This is not confirmed, but there's a couple news out today. Harvey Weinstein has tested positive for COVID-19.
Yes, we have
that listed as one of the articles tonight.
We have that in. But I would be. What I'm trying to get across is this administration has political capital because A, it won't be vilified by the Democratic side if some people mess up, and if they do mess up, we will say, well, we did it on the side of humanity, being compassionate, trying to keep an epidemic from spreading within all and killing thousands of people inside prison. We made the best decision we thought we could at the time, and we knew at the time we made the decision that some people were going to mess up. But that small number that messed up, we're dealing with them. Just exactly what the police say that you should do when they mess up. You deal with that police officer. You don't vilify the entire police force because of the one bad apple.
I'm constantly intrigued by that idea. My whole notion of what I think of police officers now, I know that when someone is knocking on my door telling me that they're going to perform bodily harm to me, I'm going to dial 911 and expect the police to show up, and I would thank them and kiss their feet as they show up. But at the same time, I see them driving around, I see them turn on their lights and drive through a red light, or they speed down a road, you know, and they do that because they can. And I'm not saying they all do it, but you could just see it on a very regular basis that there's a certain amount of scope creep of them, of the abuse of power. And I'm kind of off the topic a little bit, but I just constantly see that go by.
So, well, on this federal prison, go ahead and act aggressively, take some chances, do what we have to be at least as smart as Iran is. And they've sent tens of thousands of people.
Yeah, wasn't it 50? I saw it, but that was like just like from 80, jail or something, 80, wasn't it?
80,000, and they're sending more. I mean, they're particularly hard hit. But
because it's a powder keg of having people like locked inside of a box, and they're like, they will all just, I don't know if they'll all die, but I mean, I keep thinking of horror movies where something gets spread around and just mass pandemonium, and we have, you know, people are dying and riots breaking out. It's just horrible.
So, but I'm hoping that they'll be more aggressive than so far. I see the indication that they've not. We've got a county jail here with 1,500 to 1,700 people, and they were all proud of themselves. They've released 12 people. You know, they've released a dozen inmates. Really? You think that's going to make a difference? Now, it will make a difference for those 12. If they're vulnerable, right, they are the happy, lucky ones who got out of the power keg. So it makes all the difference of the world to them and their families. But in terms of the 1,700 that are still there, it did.
No, yeah, I heard from a mother of someone who's in prison today. She, her son has been approved to be paroled in August. And she's wondering why it is he can't get out now, given the threat and the risk of being imprisoned with this virus spreading. What would stand in the way of folks moving forward with something like that, Larry?
Well, I don't know the system in PA well enough, but what I've given as advice is that even though you don't have the power to do something, you can do it anyway in a health crisis. And unless there's a challenge mounted, and like, for example, we've got a primary coming up here. There's all this talk about what to do about the primary. And I said, well, to me, it's not a complicated thing at all. Have the governor ask the Secretary of State to issue a proclamation saying that based on the powers that she believes she has, and based on the public health crisis, that we're going to postpone the primary. And unless there's a challenge asserted in court, then it would stand even though they don't technically have the power. And I'm not asking for people to go out and just invent their own law. In fact, we're filing lawsuits in Georgia for that very reason. But this requires, legislatures are not in session, so we can't have the legislature of New Mexico run to Santa Fe and make a law saying that the primary can be postponed. Just do it. Do what the captain did that was saving the Indianapolis when all those men were in the shark-infested waters, and he turned on the lights on his vessel and said, until we can get these men out of the water, we're going to be a sitting target for all the German subs that are out there ready to fire on us. And he took a chance. He would have been court-martialed, and he would have been vilified if his ship had been sunk. But he just did it. And that's what we need to do here. Just do it. So, Teresa, I don't know if they have the power to move up his release date, but just do it. You know, that's simple. And if nobody challenges it, you had the power.
Isn't this then like the representative in Northern Kentucky that we talked about a few minutes ago? You know, if these people start releasing all, you know, the torrent of all the prisoners, whatever, then they're going to pay the price, you know, come the next election cycle, and they don't want to face that risk.
That's exactly what the timidity is. So they simply say, well, we don't have the power. Well, in extraordinary situations, I mean, we have a lot of case law, including when the U.S. Supreme Court said the internment of Japanese was okay in a national emergency. Since we don't have a lot of case law in terms of pandemics, in terms of what powers, I can't imagine a court saying, you can't release these people. Put them back in jail. I don't see that happening. So just have courage and do it. Do it responsibly, but do it quickly.
Because one of the articles that we have is from WBUR, and it's mostly just a little 5-minute audio clip. And there's more than 50 inmates in New York, at Rikers Island, the jail complex there. What did we determine last week, Larry? Is it 15,000 people are there? Is that the right number?
Originally constructed in the 1930s.
Right. And so they have 50 inmates. And if this explodes, if this, you know, if one person can transmit it easily to 20 or 30 or 50 people, 50 people expands exponentially at a very fast rate. And you end up with all 15,000 people having it probably in a matter of 2 days or something like that.
And then the question becomes of those, we know that everybody doesn't die. We know that from the global experience. But what we don't know is how many people will die that didn't have to. That we'll find out later at the end of this if we don't take any action. And I would rather be on the side of taking precautions than trying to keep people from dying. They were not sentenced to death. We need to always remember that.
And so Brenda just said, I suspect it's too late in most jails and prisons to stop the spread, which I would completely 100% agree with you. And then the next logical step would be that the prison medical system doesn't have the capacity at all to handle this kind of thing. So, and I wouldn't say that the civilian sector is able to do with it, but they probably can do better than what the prison has. So we're back to the same thing of letting people go on a more aggressive posture than not letting them go.
So, well, yeah. And when you mentioned parole, just, we were talking about the federal, the Attorney General Barr had. We don't have parole in the federal system. They abolished that in 1984. So what we have is you serve all your time less the 15% good time that you can earn in any year. And then in the final 6 months.
Does that mean it's completely outside of his control to even say, hey, look, I'm issuing an executive order
They have provisions for frail inmates and for medically infirmed and that compassionate release. They have various things that he's asking them to look more liberally at. But I'm saying, Mr. Attorney General, even if you go a step further than what you think you have the authority for, no one on our side is going to vilify you.
Yeah, you only have to look at your own camp
just
to look at his.
Just do it. We're not going to file anything because you let too many people out. We're not going to claim you're turning loose a tidal wave of crime on the United States like they did President Obama when he tried to get some people out of prison. We're not going to do that. Just do it, and you'll be fine. Some people will mess up. go ahead and announce that you expect of these 26,000 that you released that there will be some people who will mess up. And we'll do what we do to the cops that mess up. And the cops will support us because they believe that you should judge each individual and not the whole group. So we let 23,000 prisoners out of the federal system and 17 mess up. The cops would, of course, say, we'll deal with those 17 messed up, but we don't paint the whole 23,000 with that brush. I would be very confident they would say that because that's what they tell us to say about them. That's the way we're supposed to look at them when they mess up.
You don't think the victims' advocates would rise up and challenge any of this stuff?
They probably would, and we need to be firm with the victims' advocates. We need to say what I just said. They were not sentenced to die.
And they weren't sentenced to be treated cruelly either. They were sentenced to be confined and have loss of liberties and stuff like that.
And they can have severe restrictions on their liberty outside the walls of the prison. That's a misnomer that you can't have. People can be punished horrendously and not be behind prison walls.
Moving up to the NBC article, the one thing that says in there in the subtitle of it, it says that they would release temporarily 70,000 people. Would the provisions in the federal statute be like, hey, you can go home for a month, 2 months, whatever, while we resolve these issues, but you're going to report back to this institution, you know, come June 1st or something like that?
Which article are you looking at?
I'm looking at the NBC News one. It says coronavirus prompts prisoner releases around the world.
You're smoking some funny weed again. Oh, yeah.
Nope.
That NBC.
So, yeah.
Well, that was the one where it talks about countries that are releasing people far more aggressively than we are here in the U.S.
Yeah, totally. So there in the subtitle, it says that they're temporarily freed. Do you think that we would send our people home and then say, hey, come back to prison at some point?
It would depend on the posture of their sentence. Since we have in the federal system, now we're focusing exclusively on the federal system at the moment. Since we already have that for the final component of your federal prison, you're supposed to get some halfway house time and some community release time anyway. If they were within that zone, of course they wouldn't go back to prison, I don't think. If they stayed out long enough that they would have been released anyway. But someone who was serving a much longer period of time, when this crisis goes by, unless the president decides to commute their sentences, yes, they would go back to prison. It would be unfortunate, but that's what would happen.
Yeah, because it's just such a hostile environment for this kind of situation, being in prison. It's just so hostile for humans to be around this virus.
Well, I would say that if we let 10,000 out for this emergency, and the emergency abates within a year, and only 24 of those people have messed up, then perhaps we could look at going ahead and shortening their sentences, because I think they would have proven themselves to some degree. Now, that would be a really aggressive posture. But again, this administration can do things because of that they would never jeopardize the U.S. citizen security. It's kind of like we've had this discussion before. Republicans, conservatives can do things that liberals can't do, and then vice versa. It works the other way also. No Republican president could have ever signed the welfare reform bill that Bill Clinton signed in 1996, because if a Republican had dared sign that, they would have vilified him to no end. They held their nose and let Clinton sign it because he was a Democrat. So they withheld a lot of the criticism that a Republican would have gotten. So it's a two-way street. I'm not just dumping on the conservatives.
Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, the Team Blue would be able to sign things that are in their camp, and Team Red can sign for things that are in their camp. And I totally get what you're saying. Teresa, what do you think the psychological impact is of being inside the powder keg, you know, actually like being in the pot that we're calling black while the coronavirus is spreading around, and you don't know if your bunkmate, your neighbor, or somebody in the dorm has it? That's gotta weigh on people psychologically.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and completely. And it's funny, I was talking to my own son earlier. When he was in prison there, the prison he was in went on a lockdown for 2 weeks. He was 19 years old at the time. He'd never been in prison before, but there was a virus had spread through the prison, and they locked the prison down. And he was terrified. He was telling me today, you know, how grateful he is that he is not you know, that he's not in right now. And I've gotten emails and contacts from parents who have people, you know, it's not just the people on the inside, although that is awful. It's completely and totally powerless. And to have this thing that, as you know, I think on the chat, you know, there was the acknowledgement is that this thing is spreading through the prisons. It's like too late to put this back in the box, and it's happening. And there you are, you're trapped. So psychologically, it is devastating for the folks that are in there. And it's also devastating for their family because they're so powerless and there's nothing they can do. You know, I liked Larry saying, just do it, just do it. But the people that have the power to just do it aren't. And it is harming people, not just physically, but also from a psychological perspective. They're completely and totally, they're in threat. So, you know, we have three primary emotion regulation systems. Our threat system, which is great because we're always kind of looking for what's going to take us out. Our drive system, we accomplish things and move forward and get excited about stuff. And our soothing system, where we can be calm and contented and just be. And the folks that are in prisons right now, and to a lesser extent their families, are pretty much firmly planted in their threat systems. And in that place, the only emotions that arise are anger, anxiety, and disgust. And that's a really painful place to be.
Which kind of makes an interesting segue over to an article that I found today over at Vox. And it's, governors are starting to close their borders. The implications are staggering. You know, a prison is something that we can sort of visualize as being an enclosed container, a self-contained container. And, you know, just expand that out to either like your city or your county. But eventually you move up to the state level. It seems kind of crazy to me that you would be denied entry if you're on a plane that's landing and you're coming from New York City and sorry, you got to go hang out somewhere for 14 days. I mean, that's almost, you know, it's a similar situation. Hey, we're clean here. We don't want you people here.
Right. So everyone, we have this threat going on a macro level, as well as the individual level, like entire states, entire countries. I mean, China is not letting Americans in anymore because we're bringing the virus back. And
do you think they can actually do this, Larry? Can they like shut down the state borders? Isn't it? There's something in that article that talks about the constitutionality of being able to move around the states freely.
Well, there again, we're in uncharted territory because in normal circumstances, yes, but we're not in normal circumstances. And I think the courts are going to be a little bit hesitant to stop. I mean, you have said in a minute of our private conversations about how we should defer to the medical experts. And this is something the medical experts are strongly recommending, as to stop the movement of people and stop the social connections and to distance one another. And I think that in normal circumstances, it would be very problematic, and I would not support it at all. But in these situations that we find ourselves in right now, I think the courts, if such a challenge is asserted, I think the courts are going to be relatively deferential to the health authorities and to the executives that were elected that are implementing these restrictions. So I think there's a good chance that they'll withstand initial scrutiny, and they'll probably come back and visit it in a short period of time as the situation unfolds. If this subsides substantially, I think that these can't become permanent fixture in American life, but I think they'd probably withstand the initial challenge.
Very, very, it's kind of, it's just, you know, it just harkens to a different time where you actually had, you know, you had Scots against the Irish against, I mean, it sounds just like, oh, you're from the New York, so you can't come. It just reminds me of something like that.
Well, it does. I mean, it absolutely does.
It's something we've never, ever had any sort of notion to even conceive of, that we would be like, no, we're just Americans, damn it. Not from this region or that region. It's just so weird to me.
But we've accepted quarantine as a law for a long, long, long time. And this is effectively a quarantine from the hotspots.
Yes.
And yep. And so I think, you asked me what I think. I think that would probably, the courts would be very hesitant. And I hope no one jumps off of a bridge because I said that. But I think that the court actions would be turned aside and brushed away until this abates. And I think, again, if the Ohio will be the example. Governor DeWine decided to postpone the primary And somebody did go to court and said, you can't do that. And he said, oh, but I can. And the judge said, oh, but you can't. And he says, but watch me. And he did. And there was no way they could force an election when the governor said, I've shut it down. I mean, how's the court going to step in and conduct an election?
Certainly. And then also, since it's such a time-based thing, like, well, the date's already passed. So F you, we've moved on and we'll have it at a later date. What are you going to do now? It's already passed.
Well, and that's the thing with this, that these orders, I hope that this doesn't become American way of life. I hope that that this is as temporary and as temporary as it can possibly be. But we're constantly balancing between what the health experts are being very, very, very cautious about everything. And if we defer to everything the health experts, I don't think we would ever unlock the country again. So at some point, you're going to have to balance. We're going to have to balance between letting the country fall apart from being locked down, or we're going to have to find out what the appropriate risk is and how we can mitigate the risk within the higher risk members of our population. We know that it doesn't affect old age groups in the same way. We know that everybody can catch it. Now, we first thought early on that teenagers and kids couldn't get it. We've since learned that they're being diagnosed with it. But the statistics still seems to suggest that it ravages older people more than it does younger people. So we may have to, people my age and up may have to suffer more inconvenience to try to stay safer.
Right. Let's move over to an article from the Grime Report that says prison jail data show incarceration myths. There's about six or so myths down there that we should kind of go over briefly, talking about how people perceive how prisons are, but actually what they actually are. What did you want to cover here, Larry?
That's what I wanted to talk about, is that we have this myth about releasing, and we can just go through it very quickly, nonviolent drug offenders within mass incarceration. Well, the only problem is it wouldn't. 80% of the prisoners are not nonviolent drug offenders, so we would still have a record amount of people incarcerated. So that won't do it. I mean, it's a step. And then we hear the people on my side, private prisons are the corrupt heart of mass incarceration. But actually, fewer than 9% of all inmates incarcerated in the United States are private. So if you totally disbanded private prisons, we're still in the incarceration capital of the world. The other points are people in prison for violent sex crimes are too dangerous to be released. Really, the recidivism data doesn't show that. And then the one about prisons or factories behind fences to provide companies with huge slave labor, and in fact, that's also debunked. I mean, there are some people working for very low wages, but that's not what prisons exist for, to provide companies slave labor. And then there's the part about community supervision is the best way to reduce incarceration. But this study, the Institute contends that the conditions imposed on people under supervision, which is one of my pet peeves, are often so restrictive that they end up failing and being back in prison. 168,000 people in 2016. Were incarcerated for technical violations.
Wow, 168,000 people, and the feds have something of 200,000 people, right?
Right, a little less, but yeah, so, in the 200,000.
Okay, somehow we can fudge some numbers. So the people that were relocked up for some kind of technical violation almost matches the federal prison population just in 2016, and that would happen again probably in 2017, 18, and 19.
I would speculate so, and
just missing your curfew for drinking some alcohol or something like that while you're on supervision, and that violated the rules.
And that's an example of your famous technology that you're so fond of having. The more we've deployed that technology, the more stuff we can detect that we wouldn't have detected in yesteryear. We didn't know if you made curfew in yesteryear because we didn't have any way of figuring it out unless we sent out an officer to your house. We didn't know if you were drinking in yesteryear unless we happened to stumble upon it. We didn't know if you traveled to an exclusion zone in yesteryear where they said, don't go within so many feet. We didn't know all that. And technology has allowed us to know a lot of stuff that we didn't know about people that are under supervision, which leads to a lot more violations of a technical nature.
Larry, we got a backpedal. Derpy me here. I missed an article that was showing some photos from prisons in California where they're like just inches. They're feet apart of each other.
And, oh yeah, I looked over that myself.
Yeah, Teresa, what do you think about people living in such close proximity to each other?
Well, it's those images were just horrifying, and certainly it wasn't just that they were in such close proximity to one another. Environment itself, I mean, I said earlier, what's going on in our outside environment has a whole lot to do with what goes on in our insides, and there. The conditions were just pretty horrific and chaotic and filthy. The one shot of the restroom was there was a broken sink and it was dirty. And these are people who are sick, and they're sick, and there is a deadly virus going around, particularly deadly people who are already compromised health-wise and older. And we're just right back into this living in this system, in the threat system, and being consumed with anxiety and stress, hopelessness, all kinds of just really bad ways to be. I mean, it's just, this is, we put people in cages, period. And it's inhumane all the way around. I mean, not even if you're sick, but when you're sick, it makes it all that much worse. And it's just unspeakable and unacceptable. But it's what we do.
When I look at these images, I'm just like, well, that's exactly how it looked. That's exactly how it looked when I was there.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it just doesn't seem that foreign. It's like, oh, that's how it was for 6 years for me. It is crazy.
So Andy, what was it like for you psychologically?
I don't know how to word it, and I don't want to like end up classifying myself as I'm just a chameleon, and it's like, this is just what it is, and I can compartmentalize things and just like accept it for the time, and when things change, I'll just change my spots when it comes time that I need to change my spots.
Yeah. And that is, that acceptance is a pretty skillful thing to do. Mm-hmm. And you kind of intuitively go there. Yeah.
I grew up in an incredibly hostile environment where, and I don't want to go into this, but my parents were alcoholics. It was a very hostile, but so I learned from my entire upbringing that I do not know which parents are coming home. So I had to be a chameleon just my entire life. And then two branches of service, basic training and all that stuff, and dealing with military. So it's like, it wasn't that weird to me to be dealing with that.
Well,
Larry, what else do you want to cut? Go ahead, Tris.
Oh, certainly. Surely unpleasant, yeah.
Of course. Sorry, go ahead. But you can't do anything about it. It's like, I can't make them open up the door. I can't make them serve better food. I can't make somebody put money on my book so I can get some store call. I can't make the dude down the way like, hey, you're a wimpy looking white dude, I'm going to come beat your ass. I can't do anything about those things. So I just have to take them as they come.
Right. And you had that ability to accept them as they come. Yep. And the folks that don't have that, they can't accept it. It takes that real, unpleasant pain and turns it into a whole new level.
Mm-mm. Unbelievable. Larry, let's look through the remaining stories.
I would like to cover the lawsuits, the two articles that the Guardian and the not the Guardian, that's the wrong one, but the San Diego the Axel lawsuits, because we are going to be having a conference call tomorrow that only the people who are patrons will possibly get this in time. By the time it makes it to everyone else, the call will have already occurred. But at 4 o'clock Eastern time tomorrow, we're going to have a conference call talking about these lawsuits and the potential for more of them. But it relates to the forced continuation of check-ins for people who are required to register for their PFRs. Teresa, when you're talking about a registrant, we've come up with a term that a listener provided, and it's PFR.
PFR, what's that?
Persons forced to register. The Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws has filed three, and I think the fourth one is going to be filed by the end of Friday, and I don't know if it did get filed, about the continuation. So you have conflicting requirements. You have the requirements that you self-quarantine, that you shelter in place, And then you have the requirement that law enforcement says, if you don't come see us, we're going to lock you up. And you have the shelter in place. If you're going out for any reason other than food or medicine, we're going to lock you up. And that's a difficult position to be put into. NARSL called for, I forgot how many days ago we released the press release, and we did get some attention around the country on the press release. We called for all agencies to suspend in-person requirements for checking in. We understand it's in your statute. We understand that in many cases it's in your statute. In the case of California, it actually isn't in the statute. But we understand at NARSL that it's in many state statutes. Again, just do it. Nothing is going to happen to you. Nobody's going to file a lawsuit. I don't think the sex offenders that are on the registry are going to file a lawsuit and say, we want to be in your office and we want to do our check-in. So the people, the PFRs, are not going to file a lawsuit. The people who fund your local law enforcement, if it's a county agency, in the case of most of our states, it's done by county and local law enforcement. The county commissioners or the city councils are not going to try to impeach their officials for trying to protect their staff. So again, just do it. Nothing bad is going to happen.
No,
but well, that's right. You don't have to advertise it widespread. You can communicate with the offender population. But in order for something to be, as we said, you can do it until you're stopped. Whether or not you have the authority, you can do anything until you're stopped. No one is going to try to stop you from doing this. The offenders are not going to try to stop you, and the county commissions are not going to try to stop you. They want their deputies and their police officers to be safe, and no one is going to think anything about it if you just do it. Don't wait for a law to be changed. Don't wait for someone else. Do what the captain did. I wish I knew or could remember the name of that vessel, but it was when the Indianapolis was sunk. And all those men were in the water, and almost about 80% of them either drowned or were eaten up by sharks. But there was a couple hundred, 300 men being in the water, dog paddling. And he said, we're not going to sit here in the darkness and let these men not know that we're here. And so he fired up all the lights on the ship and said, we're going to give them hope until we can get them out of the water. Give these people hope. If you don't care about them, which probably some of you don't. There are some good sheriff's departments out there. There are some good leaders in law enforcement. But even if you don't care about the offenders, keep your staff safe. Do the right thing. Stop the interaction. Follow the social distancing that's being recommended. And we'll pick this nonsense up later when the crisis, when the governors and the local health officials lift the quarantine and the social distancing requirements. Just do it.
To that, though, last week, we had the article from Minnesota, I think? Nebraska. Nebraska is where it was, where the sheriff was just like, nope, you're coming in here. Don't care. Come in here. Register.
That was Douglas County, which would be Omaha, would be the seat. That was where that was from.
Okay. So it's certainly going out there. And somebody in chat says, now that the lawsuit has brought attention to it, they'll dig in their heels and they'll be like, you're damn right you're going to come in here and register.
I don't know that they will. The one against San Diego was dismissed because of procedural, because it didn't qualify for the type of relief. As people hear me say from time to time, you have to file the right cause of action, and you have to seek the relief within the vehicle that's appropriate for the relief you're seeking. And the court refused to let it go forward because they said it didn't meet the criteria for the type of action. But that doesn't mean that she can't refile it, and she will refile it. I'm quite confident that she'll refile it using the correct vehicle. But I believe that these cases will gain some traction, and I believe that some judges will take the risk of being persecuted. These are all in California, but I think some of the judges will take the risk of being persecuted, and they'll do the right thing, and they'll say, no, we're going to suspend this for the health crisis, and then we can resume later. But in California, they have all the cover they need because it isn't in the statute to begin with. This is an invented requirement that law enforcement has put into place because they don't want to do anything other than what they've always done, which is have people come down and see them in person. But it's not required that they come in person.
They could do it by email or by phone, some other method.
They could. And that's what the lawsuit,
let me give you like a personal anecdotal story about that. I come home from, being out, whatever, dinner. This is sometime last month, and there's a business card And I was like, I guess it was like a UPS sticker. And I look at it, and it's from the sheriff in the area that does the lieutenant, whatever, that does the address verification. And I was like, you know, Larry tells me he's not calling anybody. I'm not required to call. I'm not going to do it. And so I waited on it for a day. I called the next day, and I said, hey, you know, you left a card. He goes, oh, just verifying addresses. Thanks. Bye. So I'm assuming because the thing was on my door, unless someone passed it to me because now I'm living at somebody else's house, but I wouldn't have known about it unless I went to my house to get it. So he figured that that was good enough to have me registered. He didn't see me at my door. He, you know, just left a card. So it seems, you know, they could do other things if they wanted to. They just don't.
That is correct. And beyond that, the obligation is on the offender to report if they have any changes. There's very few states have an obligation that they go out and check on you continuously. Now, Maryland tried that in their regulatory framework after they passed their ramp up in 2009 that took effect in 2010. If I recall, the regulations that were published said that they shall continue to continuously verify the residence address, the registrant's address. And we made comments about that. Well, what does the word continuous mean? I mean, continuous would be not
from a statistics point of view, from a calculus point of view, it's infinity.
Right. But if theoretically that would mean that as soon as you walked away from the door, you turn around and come back.
Correct.
And if you had that regulatory framework, which is why we scared them into not going through with that regulatory framework. Whatever you did, if the person offended, and some will, I mean, there is that small fraction of people that will offend again, then it would obviously be a little bit less than what should have been done, because the victim of that offense would say, well, when's the last time you verified? We checked up on them 37 days ago. Well, maybe you should have been doing it every week, because then you have the benefit of the hindsight.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I'm with you.
In Pennsylvania, right now, they've suspended registration, and folks have to report any changes with a paper form. And if they're unable to access the paper form, which is only available online, they can call. And, you know, to Larry's point, we're talking, I mean, what we want is for the registry to go away, of course, but just the arbitrary nature of what's going on. It's like, well, if we can do this now, why can't we?
Yeah, I've been wondering that if all these measures that we do, letting people go or suspending registration, if all these things go without the world entirely exploding, then why can't they become the norm when all this goes away?
Absolutely.
So, well, let me correct.
And how much of it will stay? You know, I mean, some things are likely to change for once and for all and for good. That'll be interesting.
That is my hope, that we'll see that some of the stuff was unnecessary. But what makes that less likely is there's funding there. And this administration has been very good about funding the SMART office and making sure that the law enforcement gets everything they need. That's one of that in military spending they have just lavished on. But so I'm not as optimistic that that'll go away. But again, they have the political capital. They could make it go away. If they were serious about cutting the budget, they could say, well, gee, all the world as we know it didn't end. And we released tens of thousands of prisoners, and we stopped all this harassment of the people forced to register, and all the world, but I don't see it happening. And I know I'm not supposed to say that because it causes anxiety for folks, but I can't help myself. And I wanted to correct myself on the Maryland actually passed in 2010. It was Nebraska who passed in 2009. So Maryland did their AWA bill in 2010.
And you wanted to cover something else, Larry. Is this the Narsal article?
No, I was good with just the lawsuits and the covering there's more suits to come, and we're hoping that the threat of lawsuits in other states other than California will get more law enforcement to suspend these in-person contacts until this crisis has passed or subsided significantly.
Well, one of the statements that you just made was about defunding things somehow miraculously feeds right into a voicemail message that we got. I really think that you're going to have fun with this one, Larry. Here we go, a voicemail message.
Hey guys, hope everybody is doing okay in these crazy weird times here. Obviously, we've never experienced anything like this. So I know money doesn't really matter to politicians because they'll just print more, like this $1 trillion bailout package. So where are they going to get it? Well, it doesn't matter. They just print it anyway. But my point is it'd be a good time now to write your politicians and tell them to defund the registry, defund Angel IML, defund this whole mess. But again, they don't care where the money's come from. So anyway, thanks guys, and FYP, keep safe.
Print money, Larry.
Well, only the federal government can do that. The states are not so privileged, but I don't think that that's likely to happen. I wish it would. So I support his viewpoint, but I don't see that. We've become desensitized. I mean, we're talking about a $2.5 to possibly $6 trillion bailout here, and you know they were so upset about the $787 billion that we did back in the depths of the recession when Obama came to office. Now, just remember, folks, remember we had unemployment that had been rising for months. We had hundreds of thousands of millions of jobs lost by the time he set foot into the Oval Office. And now we have the threat of that. And it's a very real threat because of the 3 million unemployment claims that was submitted across the nation, which was about the same ratio that our state, you remember we had about a tenfold increase. Mm-hmm. Well, the nation yeah. had about a tenfold increase. In terms of, so we've got a crisis coming, but I don't think we've become so desensitized to deficit spending. And as long as the world is willing to fund our deficit spending, I think that the people have become so disconnected from it and it's become so irrelevant. No one's talked about it. I mean, we haven't really had a lot of discussion on a serious note since Ross Perot ran for president in 1992. I mean, the Republicans, when they had Obama and Clinton, they did magically were very concerned about the deficit under both of those administrations. But it's been a long time since we've heard anything about the deficit, several years now. And I don't think we're likely to hear anything about the deficit because right now they're saying, just do whatever it takes. And I tend to lean towards agreeing with them. I mean, we've got a significant problem. And a lot of these people couldn't help themselves. They were told you can't come to work. They were told you won't get a paycheck. Their employers were told to shut down. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping this experience finally sensitizes us, Americans, or whatever it is. I hope we become a little more sensitive to those who get in situations where they have not been able to function at a level that would give them basic sustenance. Because arguably, you could say that all of these companies should have had a rainy day fund. You could arguably say that all the Americans should have had a rainy day fund. I don't say that, but you could do that if you believed in survival of the fittest and that people are their own keeper and they're responsible. I believe we're all in it together. And I believe that this is probably the prudent course of action. Probably there's some stuff in those in that massive 800-page bill that we would be very shocked about if we knew. But this is probably the right course of action, but we're in this together. Hopefully we'll realize after this crisis that those hundreds of thousands and maybe over a million people that are homeless on any given day, that maybe we need to be just a little more compassionate to them as well.
I very much agree with you. Teresa, do you agree or do you not agree? You want to be a hard-nosed person and say, no, you people should have the funding and stand up on your two feet.
I told you I'm the compassionate queen. Larry, yes. This one.
You're the compassionate what? It broke up there.
Compassion queen.
Compassion queen.
Yeah.
Well, I agree that there's probably things in there that, I heard the debate and the Republicans had their problems with the $600 heaping on the state benefit as one of the things they were concerned about. And they said it would disincentivize work. They're probably right. But on the other hand, the Democrats had their issues with the lack of accountability and oversight of the hundreds of billions of dollars of corporate bailout. And those are genuine. Both sides are right. There's going to be abuse. There's going to be people who will benefit. There will be some who will take advantage of this. It's human nature. You can't design something that people can't take advantage of. The reason why they did the $600 is because even though the Republicans do have a good point about that it's going to be more lucrative for some people not to work and it's going to possibly disincentivize them, the unemployment administrators told them we don't have the systems in place that would easily identify what the person's ending wages were, what their average wages were for the last leading up to when they got separated. Cause they look back over a 52-week base period that runs usually about two quarters behind where we are right now. They would be looking at at a base period for your unemployment computation that may not even reflect what you're earning on your recent job, because your wages from your most recent job may not be even in the base period. And so those debates were genuine. There was nothing wrong with having the debates, and that's the way our system is supposed to work. You have disagreement between the ideologies, you come to a compromise, and we got this thing, and there's probably some bad stuff in it.
I understand. Larry, we need to shut this all down.
We do.
Are you ready to shut it down?
I am. So if you want to be in contact with us, 747-227-4477. And we
of course,
need
you call off the phone those. Number first.
Of course I do. And if you want to write, and then that is another way to get a hold of us, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And the best thing to do, of course, is to be a patron supporter at patreon.com/registrymatters. And if you want to find out more about Registry Matters, you can find us out find us on the web at registrymatters.co.
Man, dude, you did that all on your own. That's amazing.
That's sick, bro.
That's sick, bro. Teresa, you are an amazing guest. I can't thank you enough for coming along and sharing all of your Teresa knowledge with us.
You guys are so much fun. It's nice to be able to talk about such heavy things and see a little bit of lightness around it too.
I try. This is such a serious and depressing subject. I try and make light of it whenever I can. Larry yells at me for laughing at things too much. How can people find you, all your websites, all your Twitters, anything like that that you want to tell people?
But anyway, yes, it's Docs 86. And my email is, you can use the teresa.robertson@yahoo.com. Also, I'd encourage anyone who's in the Pennsylvania area, in the state of Pennsylvania, to check out parcel.org. And we are in dire need of help from folks who might be interested in helping us move forward. We have some great people working, we try to get up in Harrisburg, or we did until 2 weeks ago, every Tuesday, to talk with folks, and we are doing everything we possibly can. We really need tech people. If anyone's out there in Pennsylvania that can help us with technology, you can check us out on at parcel.org. And send an email, Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you again so very much. Larry, is that it? Are we done?
We're done. Good night, everybody. And thank you for what I used to say back. Good night, Chet. Good night, David. Good night from NBC News.
I thought it was you saying good night, John Boy.
No, I'm doing the news sign off from NBC from way back.
I totally know what you're talking about.
The Huntley Brinkley. The Huntley Brinkley Report.
Oh. Okay. Teresa, again, thank you. Thank you all, everybody. Thank you in chat.
Bye,
and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.